Okay. And I heard Ariel Dorfman today on Democracy Now! And the work that was happening in Chile that was destroyed by RCIA. And I just felt like I wanted to play that song as the anniversary, 9/11, is coming up for Chile also. I have on the line with me an amazing man. I was able to interview him back on April 31st. And his name is Sean Richman, and he had written a book called A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century, Tell the Bosses We're Coming. And Sean spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative. He is the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Junior School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College. He was a deputy director of organizing for the American Federation of Teachers, where he ran the union's National Charter School organizing division. As a writer, he has focused on union strategy and structure and proposals for labor law reform. He's been published in a lot of places, The American Prospect, In These Times, Jacobin, The New York Daily News, The New York Times, Staten Island Advance, The Washington Post, and Vox. This book is amazing, and what we didn't get to is the appendix, which is a labor bill of rights. And so today I wanted to bring him back in the spirit of Labor Day that comes for us now, in the face of so many unemployed people, so many people suffering and at risk, to talk about unions and how important they are. Welcome to the show, Sean Richman. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me back.
Okay. Well, you know, you and I looked at the 10 points and decided that it would not work to have all 10 of them, because it'd be like 2 minutes per issue. So I'd like you to address the right to free speech in this time. Why don't unions have free speech? What is that all about?
I mean, in general, the whole body of labor law has become unquestionably unconstitutional if you step back from it. And the appendix is, it's a white paper that I wrote about a year before the book. And so I wanted to include it just to give it more attention, because one of the things I'm trying to call out, one of the problems that unions have, I think, and I say this with a degree of love and criticism, is that in Washington, D.C., at the international unions in particularly, the labor lawyers have gotten to be the last word on strategy, and they have been pursuing a fundamentally cautious or conservative strategy of trying to keep issues out of the courts. And, I mean, for good reason, because judges are hostile to unions, not just Republican judges. A lot of Democratic judges are also, they don't come from a working-class background. They tend to sympathize more with the bosses. So the fear is, by letting an issue get into the courts, you could get a worse body of case law. And what I'm saying is, well, hey, you're not going to get up to a breakthrough unless you start challenging it. We've been suffering in silence because of these just extreme inequities in terms of how First Amendment standards are applied to corporations versus workers banding together. And finally, you're just not going to get, you're not going to break through unless you challenge this. So on the First Amendment, there is really bad Supreme Court decision that says basically workers are not allowed to criticize their employers, or at least workers who are in a union are not allowed to criticize their employers. And it dates to this Supreme Court decision called Jefferson Standard, where a bunch of workers at, I think, a cable company were frustrated that they were without a contract for too long, and they started putting out leaflets to the community talking about the poor service of their company. That the company was not expanding lines into new neighborhoods, that it was limiting the number of channel offerings to the consumers, and this was in furtherance of them getting a contract and putting some economic pressure on the employer. But the judges in the Supreme Court decision were aghast that the workers would have such disloyalty, quote unquote, to criticize the product. And as a result, we've got this body of labor law now that has just stripped. When you step into the job, if you're a unionized worker, there are things you can't say, or you could get fined triple the economic damages that the employer claims. Meanwhile, like employers are all that loyal to their workers. There's no reciprocal loyalty, and also there's no reciprocity in terms of free speech. Companies can go out and denounce and ridicule the unions that they're bargaining against in the public media. And more importantly, and this is the thing that I was really trying to put a fat finger on in the piece, because I think this is a thing that, that frankly, a Joe Biden administration could do without the Senate that can make a real difference in terms of reversing the fortunes of labor unions. There's no reciprocity in terms of free speech when it comes to the conduct of elections that will determine whether or not there will be a union at a workplace. At the moment, if there's a union election scheduled, one party and one party only gets to force all of the voters into a mandatory meeting that they can be fired if they don't attend. And in the course of that meeting, that party can lie, they can threaten people's jobs, they can hire somebody, as they do in 10% of cases at the moment, to impersonate a government agent to lie about what your rights even are. And crucially, the other party has no right to respond. And also, this is only a party, only an employer that is advocating a no vote has this right. Oddly enough, if an employer was saying, hey, a union's not bad, go ahead and choose to have a union, that would also be illegal. When you step back from that, when you describe it in those terms, when you get out of Washington, D.C., how is that not a massive violation of people's First Amendment rights? How is that not politically compelled speech? And one of the ironies here also is that, you know, the Trump NLRB is moving with incredible speed to roll back workplace rights. And one of the things they've done lately is they've passed a new rule, or they're in the process of passing it, to say that during an NLRB election, unions are entitled to a list of voters with just their names and their home addresses. They're trying to take even that away. And that list, it's called an Excelsior list. It dates to 1966. That list was given to unions as an alternative to granting equal time within a debate at a captive audience meeting. Employers have a First Amendment right to express their opinions on unionization, for sure. But for a time, the NLRB enforced an equal time standard that said, well, if an employer was going to conduct mandatory captive audience meetings, then it would trigger extra rights for the union to get onto the company's premises, to meet with workers at the workplace in break rooms or whatever, and get to do organizing conversations. And unions asked, and it ping-ponged back and forth depending on whether you had a Democrat or Republican administration. And in 66, the AFL-CIO tried to revert back to an equal time standard, and the NLRB said, try this other thing instead, this go talk to people at their homes. And anybody who's done union organizing knows that knocking on somebody's door at night after they've spent 12 hours in mandatory meetings that the employer has threatened to fire them in is just no match for the employer's speech. And so a true equal time standard, which the NLRB is fully empowered to do, it doesn't require legislation, it doesn't require court decisions, it just requires an NLRB that says, if a boss is going to do a captive audience meeting, then the union gets to be on the property, or a union speaker gets to rebut what the management is saying during that meeting. That is a First Amendment right for unions.
Right, it should be. What about the right to self-defense and mutual aid?
So self-defense for a union, our self-defense, our right to bear arms, is solidarity. And the 1947 Taft-Hartley amendments to the National Labor Relations Act effectively banned solidarity. It made it illegal for a union to take a dispute between its immediate employer to another company that has very intimate business relations with that company. So as an example, there was an Oreo cookie factory in the city of Chicago that Nabisco decided to shut down and ship the jobs over to Mexico. And, you know, solidarity would mean that the United Food and Commercial Workers at the supermarkets around the country would say, you know what, we're not going to put Oreo cookies on the shelves. I refuse to touch those packages. I will not unload those cookies from the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
That would be illegal. under the Taft-Hartley Act. And not just like slap on the wrist illegal. It would be, again, triple financial damages. So Nabisco could say, you're costing us $1 billion, and they could go directly into the courts, and the courts would say, well, you got to pay them back $3 billion. And there's no union that has that kind of money. It would destroy the union. So it's been a very effective curb on a power that could have protected a lot of unions that got busted over the years, and could be used to rebuild the power of unions. And so what I'm arguing the whole strategy of this Bill of Rights thing is, instead of trying to legislate things, just assuming that, you know, we have the filibuster and, you know, there's a lot of Republicans in the Senate, and it's been impossible to amend labor law for decades now, that our pathway here is to actually find ways to challenge these egregiously unequal applications of constitutional rights in the courts, to try to get court decisions that say, you know what, that section of the Taft-Hartley law is actually unconstitutional. Hmm. And here I'm suggesting that the way in is around this body of law around what's called signal picketing. I don't know if where you live, do you have the inflatable rats that turn up outside of construction sites or, you know, any place where there's a labor dispute? I don't know if that's just an East Coast urban thing or if that's gotten out to the West Coast.
No, I'm just laughing because of inflatable rats, but I don't know, to tell you the truth.
It's big out here, and one of the frustrating things is the rat is out there, and the rat's out there. There's no sign saying what the dispute is, and even if the union activists feel comfortable putting out leaflets, the leaflets are vague as possible. Call this CEO, tell him to start dealing with his workers, and that's all because of the Taft-Hartley Act, because of this body of law called signal picketing, which is really, you know, this is really intimately wrapped up in how judges, Democrats and Republicans alike, who have no real working class experience in their lives, just sort of view workers and unions through a prism of, I don't know what, Hollywood, I guess. They're viewing Teamsters breaking thumbs, you know, from some bad, you know, movie or sitcom or whatever from the 80s. That the rat itself, that a picket line itself is a signal of, even though it's just for information purposes, we go to pains to say, we're not telling you not to enter this facility. That's not what we're doing. We're just telling you that there's a dispute. Please call the CEO. And because the body of the case law is essentially that the mere act of having one person out leafleting in front of this place is a signal of, if you go in there, you're in trouble and we're going to beat you up, which doesn't happen. And even the signal is, I don't know, what does that signal mean when, you know, we're down to 11% of the workforce being in a union?
Right.
How many people have grown up in a union household? How many people even know what a picket line is and why you shouldn't cross it? They've effectively busted unions so well that what's the signal?
Right.
How can anybody interpret that signal? And so is very, I think, vulnerable to challenge under a First Amendment standard, because they're telling you, you can't effectively communicate, this is why we're here, and this is why we're protesting this building, this employer, this CEO.
Right. And as a retiree with a pension, because of my union membership, I can tell people that unions are important and that we should all have them. But, you know, everybody thinks that unions have a right to strike. Do they?
They do not, because an effective right to strike would have to include the right to return to the job when the strike is over, win or lose. And there was a really bad Supreme Court decision in 1938 called McKay Telegraph, which ironically was a pro-union decision, because it actually upheld the principle in the law that you can't signal out union activists for discipline during the conduct of a strike. But an idiot judge, in an offhand comment, said, but of course, if it's necessary to protect and continue his business, an employer should have the ability to hire new workers to replace those old workers, as long as he does it on a non-discriminatory basis. It's a totally illogical decision. It is in disagreement with itself. It is logically inconsistent, and it was mostly a dead letter for decades, until in 1983, a copper mining company called Phelps Dodge bargained their workers to impasse over draconian cuts in pay and benefits, dared them out on strike, and then bussed in thousands of scabs, put them up in hotel rooms, kept the company running, and after 12 months, those scabs decertified the union under the law. And then that became the blueprint for how to union bust in the 1980s and the 1990s. And McKay, I think, is wrong on the day it was decided. It has the appearance of what they call stare decisis, because no judge has ever returned to the actual original language of the act, of the decision. And the original language of the decision is, unless it is necessary and to protect and continue his business, and also it can't be done in a retaliatory or discriminatory manner. There's no instance of a boss daring its workers out on strike and then hiring permanent scabs that could meet either of those tests. There's a company in New York that bought the cable company. It's called Charter is the company, but Spectrum is the cable company now. And they did that exactly that to their long-term employees at the cable company. And they played the exact same playbook. Hired the scabs, and 12 months later, the scabs decertified. This company is making millions upon millions of dollars on a yearly basis. You know, so an NLRB that said, prove to us that your business is so marginal that if you couldn't permanently replace these workers on strike, you would go out of business. Open up your books. That alone would get all of those striking workers back to the job. But also, saying we're not going to pay for your health insurance anymore. We just bought this company. We're not happy there's a union here. We want to cut your salary in half. We don't want to pay so much in overtime. A pretty strong signal of, we bought this company, but we're not happy that we bought this union, and we want you all to go. Again, doesn't meet that challenge. And so, again, this is another example of a thing where a Biden administration could do this. Doesn't need the Senate. Doesn't need new labor law reform. It will get challenged in the courts. Because the first time that an employer tries to bust their union and gets told by a pro-worker National Labor Relations Board, you can't do that. These are temporary scabs. They're not permanent scabs. These workers are going to return to the job. That boss is going to fight that decision, drag it out through the courts. It will work its way up to the Supreme Court. But my argument is, why not? What are we afraid of? We're afraid of another Supreme Court decision that says that we don't have the right to strike. We already don't have the right to strike.
I don't know if you hear Sean. Are you there, Sean?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, sorry. I couldn't hear you through my headphones. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I missed the last thing you said. I don't know if the listeners did too or if it was just me. Can you just repeat what you just last said?
I said that the first time that a pro-worker National Labor Relations Board tells an employer, these scabs are not permanent, they're temporary, you're going to have to welcome back these striking workers at some point, that boss is going to resist and take the issue into the courts, and it's going to work its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. But why not? What are we so afraid of? Are we afraid of another Supreme Court decision that says that we don't have the right to strike? We already don't have the right to strike. And in fact, most people don't understand that, so why not let the court, the Roberts Court, reveal itself to be as anti-worker as that? But I think actually we might get a better decision, because it's just, again, sort of plainly unequal treatment under the law at this point.
Right. And I'm speaking to Sean Richman. His book is A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century, Tell the Bosses We're Coming. It's an important book, and we're just talking about the appendix right now. And if you want to learn about our country and labor law and what's been happening, I hope you'll look into this book. We have limited time together, but during COVID, I'm so worried about workers and unionized workers, but all workers, and their rights to their jobs and their rights to not be out on the street. And tell us about job rights. What rights do workers have?
Very few.
Yeah, I know, that's what it seems like.
our labor law system in this country was very much based on whether you have a union and whether you have a union contract. And when unions represented one in three workers, that worked, because the other companies that didn't have a union would try to match the rights and benefits that, that unionized workers have, if only to keep a union out of the workplace. Now that that's gone, employers lay off and terminate employees with impunity. They just, and I think everybody's experienced this, Like, there's all kinds of laws that say you can't get fired for being pregnant, but you know what? We all know somebody who, one way or the other, they were made to feel unwelcome, either during their maternity, when they return from maternity leave. So these rights don't exist. And what I have been arguing for a couple of years now is that the United States of America should join most of our peers in the industrialized world, not just European nations, but frankly, I mean, China and most of the African nations. I mean, this is a fairly standard right under the law to say that you can't be terminated from your job. You cannot be fired unless it is for a good work performance related reason, because the alternative to that is what we have if you don't have a union, which is called the at-will system, which means you're free to quit and they're free to fire you at any time. And that's, that's what gives the power to, Matt Lauer, telling production assistants during the Olympics, hey, come up to my hotel room, because you can be fired for any reason. Say, No, it's not in my job description. It's not my job description to get you your coffee. It's not my job description to pick up your dry cleaning. You could object to a thing that is objectionable on its face, but they'll still figure out another justification for firing you. And a right to your job law or just cause flips the onus, and it makes the employer prove that the reason you're getting terminated is related to your job performance. And would give you an opportunity to challenge the case that they have made, either in front of a neutral arbitrator or some sort of government agency like the National Labor Relations Board, or through a union grievance process. It's high time that America just joins our peers in the so-called free world and establish this as a basic workplace right.
All right. And, I want to ask you one more question because we're just about out of time, and I should ask you what you would like to, to stress. But, right now, there's so much going on in our country. And I read this article that I sent you called from organizingupgrade.com about No Left Without the Labor Left, and about how important it is for union members and to commit to certain bedrock principles of union democracy and working together in this intersectional way. I was wondering if you could just broad brush address the current situation for people who care about other humans.
Yeah, that's a huge question.
I know.
I agree in broad strokes with that argument. I try to focus on how do we radically increase the ranks of the labor movement as quickly as possible. Mm. A lot of our disappointments and our shortcomings with the actual present existing unions are just totally wrapped up in the fact that they're fighting a fight for their lives. They're fighting rearguard actions all the time, and they have these legal obligations to represent and protect their existing members. So when you're faced with a fight on all sides like that, the scope of what you're fighting for gets necessarily limited. In my book, my book is sort of focused on a couple of different audiences. It's focused on an audience of policymakers. It's focused on an audience of sort of opinion makers. But it's also focused on an audience of just activists, activists with unions, activists without unions. And, I think we have to be a lot, I think that workers who don't have unions have an opportunity to be a lot more creative about how we protest on the job and in our communities, and that we have to throw the playbook out. It's ironic that there's just more freedom to be a troublemaker if you're not a legally recognized union, because there's fewer legal restrictions on what you can do. And we owe it to ourselves to be more creative in thinking about how do we just ruin a boss's day. And just every day, let's just wake up thinking about how are we going to ruin the boss's day today. And we form networks of people, or join networks of people who are determined to ruin the boss's day today, because that's what's ultimately going to bring real change in this country.
Yeah, and that's hard to even say during COVID, because if your boss has a bad day, you might lose the business. So, you know, it's just it's such rough times out there. But I really want to thank you for this book, and I hope that people will look into it, because we all need to understand this better so we're better supporters. And it is Labor Day, so this would be a great weekend for people to get it. Can they find this, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, online, Sean Richman?
Yeah, you can get it direct from the publisher, which is Monthly Review. I believe it's monthlyreview.org is the address. If you have a favorite local bookstore, order it from them, because the local bookstores are really hurting.
Yeah.
And then, irony of ironies, you know, if you really want to help me out in terms of getting this anywhere close to the bestsellers list, buying it on Amazon and leaving a review is, unfortunately, the most important rubric. I hate it. I hate the world that we live in because of things like that.
I won't buy anything on Amazon. But thank you very much, Sean Richman, for everything that you've done in order to support workers. And happy Labor Day to you and all of our listeners.
Same to you. Thank you, comrade.
All right. Bye. Comrade. Hey, this is the Peace and Justice Show, and we're going to go next to a recording that Bill Mash did. It's an important one. And I just want to say that next week we have to do a mini fundraiser. And I'm just very excited about this, although I have no idea how I'm going to combine talking about Gaza and beer. But we'll find a way, and because there will be a special release for a KZFR beer that's coming out that Sierra Nevada has very kindly dedicated to us. It's called Hopped as High as Nimshu Ridge. This resinous IPA celebrates 30 years of community public radio at 90.1 FM. Countless volunteers fill the airwaves with diverse music, news programs, and eclectic ideas, helping the North State stay informed and enlightened. Cheers to our longtime partner who empowers the people. And that is a kindest, most wonderful thing. So I just really, really appreciate Sierra Nevada for recognizing KZFR. And we will use the opportunity to try to raise some funds, because, as you know, our pledge drive was not, we can't just do it in person anymore. So it's hard to make much money for the station. So this recording that's coming up that Bill Mash did is on Jacob Blake, and David Phillips reads. David Phillips is the father of Desmond Phillips, who was a young black man who was in a mental health crisis when he was killed by Chico's police department rookies. And David Phillips is reading a poem from the 2020 Butcher Shop, which will go on, by poet Corey Hemp Hunt. So I'm looking forward to that. I have not heard this yet. I want to read something before I put it on. I have time to do that. Something that Bill Mash put on that I thought was important on Facebook. Murder is what Officer Rustin Chesky intended when he pulled the trigger 7 times. So much so I misspoke in my radio segment several times calling it a killing. How does one survive 7 point blank shots to the back? The mind plays tricks. No one could survive that. But survived Jacob Blake has, to the relief of his family and loved ones. The hashtag Justice for Jacob Blake segment brought me a sense of peace and a sense of closure. More importantly, it gave me an opportunity to explore the need for love and forgiveness with David Phillips amidst the pressing need to focus our energy on things within our grasp, such as loving thy neighbor while demanding change on a life raft sailing a tsunami of enough is enough. So with that note, let's go ahead and listen to this recording.
The chaos in the streets was all too familiar. Community members yelling for mercy as another sworn peace officer in blue points their gun at the back of an unarmed black man. 7 shots are fired, drowning out the screams of horrified bystanders. Miraculously, Jacob Blake survives his point-blank wounds, while the nation views another viral YouTube video dividing the nation along well-established racist lines. "He should have yielded to the police," says Senator Lindsey Graham, while Jacob's dad grieves and relives the seven shots, asking why. I immediately thought of David Phillips, a still grieving dad who watched his son gunned down in a hail of Chico, California police gunfire in his living room in March of 2017. "Justice for Desmond" was the rally cry as concerned citizens of mixed race came together to stand up to police brutality here, there, and everywhere. The Justice for Desmond Phillips Facebook group describes Desmond's murder thusly. Desmond Phillips was killed by Chico police March 17, 2017. His father called the ambulance to assist him with his son's mental episode. Desmond suffered head trauma that altered his mental state. Instead of defusing the situation, Chico police tased Desmond and then opened fire on him. Several of the bullets entered the head, neck, and chest of Desmond, killing him instantly. They then handcuffed his body and took him to a nearby hospital. The news media and Chico police are stating that he lunged at the police. Eyewitnesses say that they tased him, and as he fell to the ground, they fired their guns and killed him. This page is here to tell the truth, the real story behind Desmond's death. Here's local activist Corey Himphunt's Justice for Desmond poem, followed by a 15-minute interview with Desmond's dad, David Phillips, on yet again another shooting of a person of color by the police, and another name added to the list of unarmed black Americans killed by the police, Jacob Blake. Say his name.
"So much pain, so much hate. While so many die, when others look away, I'ma share peace and create space. Let's share peace and create space. So many arguing what's not the truth, and they never even truly knew. It would be silly too if it didn't cost so many based on the hue of the skin. They ain't even get a chance to choose. Advancement of the youth damaged by the rules. Not a roadblock but a broken branch of clues. A few construe and use while the average confused lose hope and use dope. I climbed out and groove soul, Negro spiritual dream flow. A vat of that. We might not make it to the mountaintop, but we see the gleam, no. With a clean coat in the mean snow, I've grown a hardened shell from a darkened trail to dance with Gargamel and come back and tell his secrets. The reasons, I'll be clear. As possible and logical, some obstacles take lots of skull. The skill and will of patience, painted faintly across the cross of ink, this kind of thankless we bear when making changes where there's no complaining. Maybe that's why we keep complaining. Or could it be the shaming, gunning down a man you was paid to protect because you wasn't trained enough to contain him? And that's before explaining what part racial persuasion plays in the fear of Caucasian government agents. American conditioning goes both ways, and too many of us is afraid to say this. So many in the U.S. are unwilling to see it. So scared they're gonna lose what they never knew they had, they couldn't believe it. Meaning to protesters and speakers, then killers in the street are a favorite change of topic.